Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. I'm your host, Dr. Dave O'Brien. On this episode, I'm talking to Dr. Tom Mills from Aston University about his new book, The BBC, Myth of a Public Service, which is published by Verso in 2016. Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'll be talking to Dr. Tom Mills, who is a lecturer in sociology at Aston University in Birmingham, about his new book, The BBC, The Myth of a Public Service, which is published by Verso this year. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
This is a really timely book, I think, for a whole variety of reasons. In the UK, there's been a big debate about the future of the BBC because it's having its charter renewed. Obviously, there's been a lot of discussion about the kind of the role of media in particularly politics, but more widely, the social role of media, given the recent political events, both in the States and in the UK. So this book, I think, enters these debates at the perfect time with a quite critical perspective on the BBC. And I wonder, before we kind of get into the book, if you could tell me a little bit about where the book came from and where the kind of the project emerged from.
Yeah, sure. So I first became interested in the topic, I suppose, in the context of the Iraq War, and one of the interesting things about that I think was the first time that I became interested, because there was a report that came out that was conducted by some academics at Cardiff University that examined the BBC's coverage of the Iraq War. And what it found was that the BBC had been more pro-war in terms of the voices that appeared on news programmes than the other major broadcasters. This is quite interesting. I wanted to know what was going on behind the scenes there, how we could understand the kind of culture and practices which were producing this reporting. So that was broadly what I was interested in. I started a PhD up in Glasgow before the crash, the financial crash in 2008. So I think I started my research, my PhD research, more or less as Lehman Brothers was collapsing. And then so what I ended up doing, although initially I'd been interested in a kind of institutional account of the BBC with a particular interest in war, I then shifted towards my interest towards economics reporting and neoliberalism, and that's what I focused on in my PhD. And this book incorporates that work from my PhD, and it covers these other areas. So it includes a chapter on war, a chapter on the BBC's relationship with the secret state. So that's the context of the book.
Yeah, it's quite nice in that respect, actually, that it's got a fairly comprehensive take on the BBC's kind of social role around things like reporting, but also with that, as you say, you know, kind of war, secrecy, economics, bureaucracy, these kind of things. And I think we'll get into these over the course of the podcast. And I think the place to start is with a wonderful kind of phrase that occurs quite early on in the book about kind of setting the record straight about the BBC. And the book kind of positions itself in dialogue, but also in opposition to existing academic accounts and kind of official histories. And I wonder, you know, what's the kind of project to set the record straight, and why do we need to rethink the BBC now?
Yeah, well, I suppose there's two aspects of this. There's first of all, how these things tend to get discussed in public life, you know, particularly in journalism, and secondly, how we tend to understand it within academia. And you know, there's different things to say about both. First of all, I think in the newspapers, within the media itself, there's a sort of excessive focus on the idea of the BBC as being this kind of left-wing organization, and that's something I talk about in the book, the way in which the right has mobilized this idea. So there's that aspect, which I think is quite misleading. Now, in terms of, we can talk about that further maybe. In terms of academia, I think the picture is slightly more complicated. I mean, the existing accounts we have, I guess, would fall within several categories. I mean, firstly, there's the journalistic accounts, the accounts written by BBC journalists themselves, who tend to have rather idealistic conceptions of their work and their place in society, and they tend to particularly focus on the conflicts between journalists and politicians. And there's also a body, I suppose, of scholarly work which more or less writes in that tradition, coming out of less sort of critical journalism schools and media histories. The historical accounts, you have more critical accounts which are very good, which ask critical questions about the BBC and its relationship with the state, its positions on imperialism. Many of those focus on earlier periods, and then there are more liberal sort of official histories as well. So Asa Briggs's history, and now Gene Seaton, who's now the official historian of the BBC, and these draw on, you know, that they offer a lot of insights into the BBC's institutional history. What they tend to do less well is to integrate that within a broader analysis of what's going on in British society. And what I was trying to do with this book is to try and position that culture of the BBC within broader questions about the history of British democracy, particularly the rise of neoliberalism. And the less critical historical accounts tend to mirror that problem with the journalist accounts, that they tend to focus on conflicts between journalists and politicians, and not ask questions about particularly, you know, when those two groups might agree. And that leaves out a whole broad area of things we should be concerned with. Thirdly, there's the sociological work on the BBC, and I've included it within that media and cultural studies. So here, there's some very good ethnographic studies which I reference, a handful of interesting sociological ethnographic studies, and there's a lot of work on media content. What I've tried to do here is to connect these things, to bring these bodies of work together. So there's one of the problems with the historical and journalistic accounts is they more or less completely ignore the social scientific evidence on the BBC's actual reporting. And I think that has very important implications for how we understand the BBC. So I'm drawing a lot of that work and critiquing, as you say, as I go through.
The obvious kind of route into to that broad basis for the book is with these kind of keywords that underpin how we understand the BBC in Britain through ideas of kind of impartiality or the BBC being independent. And you give, you know, historical examples of when the BBC really hasn't been impartial and independent. And in the first chapter, you try and relate the BBC more broadly to kind of the British state, kind of widely or broadly defined. So I wonder if you could talk me through what impartiality and independence kind of means, and why these terms are both kind of important to constructions of the BBC, but why they might be misleading as well.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, first of all, this notion of independence, you know, it's very central to the BBC and to the whole idea of public service broadcasting, which is basically that, you know, the BBC is not a corporation, it's not part of the market, it's independent of economic forces, and secondly, that it's independent of politicians and the state, so that it operates as independently of those centres of power. Now, I think if you begin to look closely at the BBC, and it's very clear, even from its very earliest very earliest time that the BBC hasn't been independent in that sort of substantive sense. It's certainly not been independent of the state and politicians, and you can see that from day one. I mean, the classic test of it was in the general strike in 1926. Now, impartiality is essentially the working out of that in terms of journalistic practice, i.e. how do we report, who gets to speak and the rest of it. And the idea is of that is that, yeah, the BBC will independently and impartially report some things without letting particularly interests encroach on how it reports. Now, to take the example of the general strike, you know, the founding father of the BBC, its first general manager and then Director General John Reith, said that the government could trust us to not be impartial. He's very explicit about that. And he also said that the BBC was not independent during the general strike. So that was the BBC at its very beginning. And then the question then becomes, okay, well, has the BBC become more independent and more impartial? And the answer, if you look at the evidence, is that it has basically tended to reflect the interests of powerful people in society, that the Westminster and the political elites tend to define the basis of political discussion. And as since the 1980s particularly, you know, the BBC has been more incorporated into the market, and that's something I talk about quite extensively in the book. So these kind of key measures, these way which we understand the BBC, which are very central also to how BBC journalists understand themselves, if you actually look at the evidence, you find that it's not meeting these key kind of tests of its own role.
I mean, one way that this occurs is, and you discuss this in chapter two, is the really, you know, quite explicit relationship between Britain's secret state, its intelligence services, and the politics of BBC staff, particularly in terms of vetting BBC staff. And it's really interesting in that second chapter because impartiality or independence would have us think that the BBC is an institution that, you know, is kind of resistant to outside influences, you know, kind of cautious when confronted with demands from, you know, intelligence services to vet staff or these kinds of things. But actually, you make the case and the argument that what's really going on here is the BBC encouraged a relationship with Britain's secret state and you know, kind of welcomed much more extensive practices such as vetting. So I wonder if you could lay out, you know, what that relationship is, what those practices were, and maybe some of the kind of, you know, the consequences of that relationship up to the present day.
Yeah, so basically what happened with this vetting, which went on at the BBC for 50 years, was that the BBC at the most senior level had these fairly informal contacts with MI5, the secret service, and the security service, and they had initiated this secret program whereby staff who had any involvement in editorial decision making or broadcasting of any kind had to be approved by MI5, and their files would go from the BBC to MI5 and then back again, and an employee at the BBC would stamp them if they were deemed to be subversive. So essentially what this meant was if your politics were deemed to be unacceptable or too generally too left-wing for the secret state, then you wouldn't be employed at the BBC. Now, this was discovered in 1985 by a group of observer journalists, and the way that it had been understood at the time was, yes, more or less that the secret state had restrained the BBC, that it had enforced this program. And actually, the files that we have, which are a mix of files which have been made available to the official historian of MI5 and the BBC, and some other files which were obtained under the Freedom of Information Act, show fairly unambiguously that what in fact happened was that the people at the senior level of the BBC had been in touch with MI5, and they'd reached a sort of mutual understanding that this would be in the interest both of MI5 and the BBC. And over several periods, MI5 tried to draw back from the practice of vetting, and then the BBC pushed back and tried to expand it. So you get a context picture here where the MI5 becomes useful to the people at the top of the BBC hierarchy in terms of managing the political nature of its content, which is part of its own relationship with the political elites, and but at the same time, which isn't known to the majority of staff. So this is one of the things which comes up in the book again and again, is that if you start to think of the BBC as this kind of single organization, you actually get a fairly a limited picture of what's actually going on, because what actually seems to be the case is that there's struggles within the BBC over how impartiality and these ideas get to be defined. And during periods of political stress, you see this kind of cohesion between the people at the top of the BBC and the people at the top of other institutions, particularly Whitehall and Westminster. Again, you see a similar pattern emerging when it comes to war. You know, the BBC has this kind of institutional interest in appearing to be independent of the state, and the state has an interest in the BBC also appearing to be independent as well, and you get this kind of meeting of minds at the higher level.
Yeah, war reporting, foreign policy reporting, and the BBC's relationship with Whitehall, I think is crucial here, and it'd be good to know how that relationship kind of sets the terms for BBC reporting.
Yeah, so the two major conflicts which I talk about in the book, I mean, I talk a bit about the Second World War and how that relates to the general strike, but the major periods of political crisis in Britain and the BBC, the American-led invasion of Iraq in 2003 and the Suez Canal crisis, which in 1956, is it, I think, or is it 58? In any case, these are the two kind of celebrated examples of the BBC's independence. And because what happens there is that the higher levels of the BBC leadership come into a very bitter conflict with Downing Street over its reporting, and in the case of Iraq, there was a report by Andrew Gilligan, who was then a journalist on the Today programme, which is BBC Radio 4's sort of flagship current affairs programme, claiming that Number 10 had sexed up this dossier, this case for war. And the conventional kind of spin on this, which is kind of intuitive, is that the BBC had been reporting independently, and it was attacked by the Labour government over that reporting, and it was basically cowed by the state. And that's broadly speaking correct. But again, if you look very closely, a slightly more complicated picture starts to emerge. First of all, the BBC's reporting was in any case, and I alluded to this earlier, was in any case not in any way critical of the government's policy. They were very favourable in terms of how they reported. It doesn't mean that they always completely echoed the case for war, but that was overwhelming what defined BBC's reporting. Secondly, the people who were involved in this report, John Humphreys, who's still on the Today programme, and Kevin Marshall, as then editor, had been in touch with MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service, before they ran this report, and they were being briefed by by MI6. And they were told that they were worried that they wouldn't find weapons of mass destruction. And at the same time, they were being briefed by members of the cabinet and so on. So they have these strong sources within the British state that are telling them that something's gone awry here, that the case for war wasn't watertight. And that's what then gives them the confidence to run the famous report, which claims that Downing Street sex on the dossier. So it slightly complicates the picture again in terms of how the BBC is relating to the state, because in the case of if you look at it very narrowly between in terms of Downing Street and political parties, it's very clear there's a political conflict going on. If you take a broader sociological understanding of the British state, you can understand this in terms of elite dissent and a lack of and a certain anxiety within the British state, which then becomes reflected in BBC reporting. So I think it gives you a different understanding of where the BBC fits into that picture. The other element which is worth mentioning is you know, the personal relationship between people at the top of the BBC and the people at the top of the British state, that is to say the politicians and the rest of them, because the people who lose their positions, Gavin Davis and Greg Dyke, were both very close to Tony Blair and Gordon Brown. You know, they were political appointees who were part of the sort of New Labour terms, if you like. And you can see the same thing in the case of the BBC during the Suez crisis. The chairman was very close to Anthony Eden, the Prime Minister, and there's this kind of extensive formal and informal connections between people at the top of the BBC and the top of the British state.
Yeah, this kind of, I mean, I think of it as the kind of class basis for the BBC. Really just to question some of the kind of classic critiques of the BBC, that it's a left-wing organisation. And I wonder if you could talk through the sort of the politics of the BBC in terms of right-wing critiques of it, but how this might relate to precisely that kind of set of relationships you've drawn around the Iraq War and the Suez Crisis.
Yeah, so I mentioned this earlier, that, you know, the kind of common sense around the BBC is that it's a left-wing organisation. I mean, the politics of the BBC has always been this kind of very hotly contested. I mean, for obvious reasons, if you've got competing factions within the political elite, they're trying to influence reporting to their own advantage. So, you know, naturally, you're going to have this kind of contestation around how party politics is reported and how policy is reported. But there's kind of a marked shift in the 80s, particularly as Thatcherism starts to take off, when there's this kind of mobilization of the idea that the BBC is a left-wing institution. And what's interesting about this is that in the earlier period, in the 1970s, it was kind of... The conventional wisdom was more or less that the BBC was kind of a small C conservative organisation. In the ways we've been discussing, it was very connected to the British state and the broader establishment, which I think is a much better way of understanding the politics of the BBC. But what starts to happen is that as the new rights, the Thatcherites, start to try and shift British society rightwards, there's these very aggressive political campaigns that take place over the politics of the BBC, and at the same time the policy agenda around broadcasting and around media has a marked shift in a neoliberal direction. So what this amounts to, I think, is an attempt by a particular faction of the elite to push to reshape British society in a certain direction. And from their perspective, you know, the BBC had more or less internalized and taken for granted some of the culture of, you know, the post-war consensus, the Keynesian kind of corporatist approach, which had characterized British society from 1945 to broadly the mid-70s and into the 80s. There's a certain assumptions about the role of trade unionisms for employment class and all of the rest of it. And the BBC was bound up with that. You know, there was clearly a program to transform the BBC and shift its culture. And that's part of what I talk about quite extensively in the book, is how the BBC itself was transformed in the neoliberal period, you know, by the neoliberals. But the key thing about this is that, you know, the BBC was always part, in class terms, you know, it was a middle-class organisation, I mean, in terms of its kind of culture, but also, you know, it was broadly small-c conservative in the sense that its staff were being drawn from that particular strata. It was, you know, heavily orientated towards official politics.
I mean, if that's the kind of class formation for the BBC, what are the techniques, the kind of management, administration, bureaucratic techniques that have transformed the BBC since the early 1980s that have, you know, kind of reflected that sort of neoliberal faction within elite dominance of British society?
Yeah, so... this sort of starts around the mid-1980s. I mean, Thatcher and the people around her are sort of agitated for the BBC to have to take advertising, which was, you know, seen as a way that it might be shifted in a more business-friendly direction. And she appoints this guy called Alan Peacock, who is at the Institute for Economic Affairs, which is, you know, the foremost neoliberal think tank in the UK. He's a head of an inquiry into the funding of the BBC. And the hope is that they will say the BBC should take advertising. They don't actually do that. What they suggest is that the sort of ecology of the British media needs to shift into a more consumerist direction, and they leave the license fee as it is, and they don't recommend advertising. But what they suggest is that the BBC should commission content from the private sector, and that this will introduce a sort of a step towards a more neoliberal model of broadcasting. So there's that in the background, and then there's not really at the same time there's lots of attacks on the BBC in terms of, you know, its funding and its efficiency and all of the rest of it, which was very much part of how, you know, the neoliberals mobilized against the social democratic state. But it's not really until the 1990s with the arrival of Director General John Burt where a real radical transformation happens in the BBC. And what Burt does is he arrives with this notion that he wants to shift the BBC away from this social democratic post-war consensus to come to terms with Thatcherism, as he himself says it. And there's two elements of that. I mean, he pushes more business reporting. He abolishes some of the social democratic patterns of reporting, but he brings in a particular managerial model called producer choice, which was essentially an internal market, which would increase business values at the BBC, but at the same time also integrate it into the capitalist market, which would basically meant that you had to buy and sell programmes within the BBC, that a market would be created which would allow the BBC to compete on a level terms with private providers, and importantly and this is connected to this initiative that comes out of the Peacock Report, which says that the BBC needs to bring in a certain proportion of its programming from the private sector. So the effect of all this is that the BBC becomes much more managerial and more business orientated, and more driven towards that kind of culture. And this is something which is happening across the public sector around this time, that wasn't quite identified for what it was, which was really a sort of institutionalized form of neoliberalism at the British state, partly because people tended to see neoliberalism as being this kind of free market model, and then to see the kind of initiatives that were being introduced at places like the BBC or the NHS and not see them as being part of that same project, because they didn't seem to be free market ideas. But of course, we now have a much more sophisticated understanding about what neoliberalism was, and recognised much more broadly what was then called the new public management was very much part of that neoliberal vision.
Let's bring it all together then and think about economics reporting, because I think that penultimate chapter in the book really does kind of coalesce these themes together to give us a case study of both the kind of the transformations at the BBC, its long-standing kind of historically grounded problems, and then the social consequences of this. So how has economics reporting changed? How can we relate this to the kind of broader social issues, such as, you know, strikes, and then these kind of political programs, particularly privatization, that forms the backdrop for the kinds of reforms you've been talking about?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is a very long process that stretches out for the whole of the neoliberal period, you know, to Thatcherism and then particularly to the period from around the ascension of New Labour, where the BBC's reporting practices, I mean, changed really quite dramatically. In the 1970s, The reporting of business was more or less the responsibility of the labour or industrial correspondent. And they were particularly orientated towards what was going on with the trade unions. And there's some very interesting work from around that time, which was looking at how the economic crisis of the 1970s was reported in terms of this excessive focus on the unions. And, you know, the unions are seen as basically, from the perspective of being an economic problem, particularly strikes. But What at least happened was that the BBC had people there who were experts on the unions. They had relations with those institutions, and they also understood Britain as being a country with workers in it, you know, and that was reflected in the BBC's reporting. And what starts to change is that, first of all, in the aftermath of the miners' strike and privatisation and the rest of it, and particularly the arrival at the BBC of John Burt when he headed BBC journalism in 1987, after the Director General Alistair Milne had been forced to resign by political appointments on the Board of Governors, is that reporting starts to shift in a much more business-friendly direction. The BBC starts to bring in people specifically to report on from a market perspective, and particularly to report on economics and business. And this starts to proliferate as the Labour correspondents start to become much more marginalised. And then by the time you get into the 1990s, the Labour correspondents have more or less disappeared. Some of them are sort of summarily fired, which is something that I recount in the book. And there's this kind of explosion of business and economic reporting that takes place. There's sort of two elements to this. I mean, one side of it is the more sort of technocratic economic reporting. Now, John Burt, when he becomes Director General, he appoints this guy, Peter Jay, to head his economics reporting. He's an old friend of his. He was a very important figure in popularising monetarism in the 1970s, and you know, was close to Friedman, and John Burt himself used to lunch at the Institute for Economic Affairs. So he was a, you know, pretty explicitly a neoliberal and a Labourite like John Burt, and he heads the BBC's economics reporting. And then at the same time as you get that more sort of technocratic, high-minded economics news, you have these kind of more populist kind of business programs that start to emerge at the same time. And the BBC has this kind of idea that, you know, it needs to be sensitive to this sort of flourishing of popular capitalism that happens around Big Bang. That's the deregulation of London's financial sector and the privatization of the formerly publicly owned utilities. And that programming really grows in the 1990s. And these become consolidated into one unit towards the end of the 1990s. And with the arrival of Greg Dyke as Director General in 1999, he really pushes business reporting up the agenda. And then what he does is he appoints this guy, Jeff Randall, as a business editor. So the idea here was that by this point, the complaints come from the right that the BBC is reporting too much from the perspective of consumers and isn't sensitive to the needs of business. And we need to understand, you know, Britain as a nation of shareholders as well as consumers, right? So that starts to proliferate enormously. Business news comes up the agenda. And then by the time we get to the economic crash in 2008, these are the voices which are basically defining how what happened is understood. And there's some interesting work on that. When you look at the BBC's reporting, and one of the kind of ironies of this is that when neoliberalism seems to just collapse in 2008, that's the point at which, you know, neoliberal or neoclassical ideas about how the economy should function just sort of come to the fore at the BBC. So ironically, what doesn't happen is that these ideas start to be questioned. I mean, all of the institutional changes are there. People like Robert Peston come in and become the dominant voices. And by that point, it's institutionally been the BBC's DNA to, you know, to approach business in as a kind of, you know, almost like a technocratic kind of group rather than a particular interest. So there's a long-term shift that takes place from the idea of business as a particular sector of society with a particular set of interests towards business either as not being an interest or as even a sort of catch-all term for all elements of economic life. And what falls out of that is any understanding of the public as being workers and as that having a particular set of interests, or as business as a particularly powerful set of economic actors which are able to influence policy and influence politics, which is, of course, what's going on in the background with this neoliberalism, you know, this market idea, is that the state has been gradually eroded and become much more business orientated. And what went on at the BBC in terms of both its culture and its reporting mirrors that kind of process.
The place to conclude, I think, is what should we do about it then? Like, what is worth kind of defending from the BBC, and how can we kind of save what is worth defending, given that your conclusion points to the idea that the BBC is not actually impartial, independent, loyal to democracy, but actually is loyal to the political institutions and the British state?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's worth saying, because we haven't so far, you know, that the BBC is a much broader institution than what I talk about in the book. I mean, the focus is mainly on the BBC's journalism, which is, of course, only one element of what it does in terms of its, you know, cultural production. So it's worth bearing that in mind in terms of how this is, you know, influencing the nature of discussion. I mean, in terms of what's worth saving in the BBC, you know, I think these values in terms of the BBC's independence and impartiality are very worthwhile values. You know, they're not anything which I think we should necessarily dismiss lightly. I don't think we should take them as face value. You know, I mean, I think in some ways they're very vague concepts, but they do embody a certain principles, which I think are very important, which is that in order for democracy to function, we need to have institutions which are able to find out things about the world and report back, and to report reliably on that, and educate and assist the public in their understanding of decision making. I think all of that is very worthwhile. I think the difficulty of how we've approached the BBC is partly that it's been very difficult to even have a discussion about what the BBC is, partly because of what's gone on historically with the BBC, with the threat to it from the right, the gradual erosion of those kind of values, and the fear that, you know, the BBC will more or less disappear, and maybe we end up with something like Fox News, or a broadcasting version of, you know, of News International and The Sun and all the rest of it. So I think the question has to be, first of all, you know, let's have a discussion about what we want from the BBC based on what the BBC actually does, rather than what we imagine or we would like it to do. And then secondly, how might we reform the BBC in a way which would meet some of those values? Now, when it comes to that question, I think, you know, if you look at the history and you look at some of the things that I talk about in the book, I mean, some very obvious things would, I think, occur to you. First of all, it would be to try and reform the institution so that to take it away from the political influence of the state. So to try and find ways of removing some of those levers of elite influence, particularly over the BBC's funding, over the appointment system and the charter renewal process, which we've just gone through, and the rest of it. And the second is the question of, you know, how the BBC's institutional culture is, in terms of its journalistic practices, take place. I think it's another important question. So we can remove those elements of political influence, but I think we need to be thinking much more ambitiously as we're going into a sort of a post-broadcasting age about how we would like to structure journalism. And here I think it's important that we start to think more democratically, not only about how the BBC is run, but maybe how the journalism is being performed as well. And I think there's lots of opportunities there as the technology starts to develop for more substantive public involvement in the BBC, perhaps in terms of its budgeting, in terms of the sorts of things it reports on. And yeah, one of those elements has been things like discussed by Dan Hind over public commissioning. So I think these are all things which we need to be thinking about. But I think the question has to be whether simply defending the BBC as it is, which has been the sort of basic position of the left and of liberals in response to the threat from the right, I think it's basically got us nowhere. And what we've seen is this gradual erosion of these values, which, as I describe in the book, were never really very substantially lived up to, even in the social democratic period. But as we have this drift rightwards, this erosion of democratic institutions, I really can't see the BBC itself as being institutionally able to reform itself. And eventually it's not going to be able to substantively perform, you know, its stated function in any sense. You know, that's we're seeing this gradual erosion, which has been intensified as a result of the current charter renewal process.
In terms of your own work, are you sort of carrying on working on questions about the BBC, media regulation, the sociology of media, or are you kind of doing completely different things now you've kind of, I guess, sort of settled accounts with the Beat?
Well, I'd like to do a bit more publishing around the BBC. So I've got a bit more writing to do on that. But that will be the end of my, I expect, I don't know, it will be for the time being anyway, the end of my my BBC project. I've got the couple of things that I'm working on at the moment with a former colleague of mine at Bath University, David Miller, is first of all a project on terrorism experts, looking at how people who appear in the news commenting on terrorism, their particular connections to think tanks and the state. So there's that work. And I'm also doing some work on Islamophobia, which is looking at how Islamophobia as a set of first of all state practices, but also influenced by what we call social movements from above. So that's to say movements made up of elite political actors. So my research interests are broadly in political sociology and the sociology of communication and expertise as well, and elite social movements, and you probably see some of that coming across in the approach I take to the BBC. So that's the immediate direction that I'm taking that in. My main interest, is really in a political sociology of elites. So that's where, and with a particular interest in communication and media, which is where this book fits into that.
Thanks for listening to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I was talking to Dr. Tom Mills from Aston University about the BBC Myth of the Public Service, which is published by Burson. We'll